is signifying, maybe. You are what you've collected. The tennis racket you never now use, the tin opener you regularly lose your temper with, the drawer loaded with photographs of people you no longer speak to, the painting by someone you'd happily kill, the €300 voucher for driving lessons you never took, tax bills for each of the past 5 years, a letter from your accountant that says everything is going to be okay, the purple tie you borrowed from your mother's oncologist, the 57 different varieties of God, every one of them false, the cardboard box where you stash letters from the Antichrist solicitor, the woman with two dogs and half a mind you once lived with, the cat buried at the bottom of the garden, this drafty upstairs window from which you can see houses full of things you're not. The next one has another self-explanatory title, really. It's called Remembering the 90s. Donald Davies, the British poet, had a poem, Remembering the 30s, and looked back on the era of Auden and W. McNeice in terms of poetry from the vantage point of the 1950s. And I think now, the 1990s in Ireland looks like another world. Remember all that nonsense about Generation X and alienation? God, wasn't it so hard for it to be in Ireland in 1995 or 6? It didn't really have a part. Remembering the 90s after Donald David. Our hair got smaller and the TV went on forever. We waited for the Stone Roses' second album or watched Party at Five. In Washington, committees gathered to frown at what had gone on in the president's trousers. Northern Ireland paused for what would eventually become a fully formed thought. Rwanda was a machete with names on it that sounded nothing like ours. We protested French nuclear testing by sampling South African white wines, newfound innocence. Osama bin Laden was a rumor no one believed, and Saddam Hussein an occasional burst of stomach acid up the esophagus. We could board planes without anyone having to see us naked through a machine first, and made our no to apathy heard by not bothering to vote. While we planned trips to places we couldn't yet pronounce, politicians bickered about the remains begging on Shop Street. History was in the bathroom, putting on her new face. This is from Friday New Furniture. Me and a friend of mine had this joke about that when the Celtic Tiger collapsed, how long would it be before the statues started to move again? When I was leaving school, we had the wave of moving statues. It was the darkest point, kind of will the last person to leave please turn out the light point of the 1980s. We had the sun spinning in the sky over Knock and people going almost blind, looking at it apparently earlier. But then Jesus apparently appeared in a tree stump in Cork. It always somehow seems to begin in Cork. Apologies to anyone from there. It's a big county. That was my country after. It's kind of a nostalgic look back at the era we've just left us. Just as I had begun to think, oh, well, this isn't too bad in 2008, it all fell apart, which everything generally does. Carolyn Duffy had a poem, This Is My Country, about Britain in the 1980s, and this is after her, That Was My Country. The phasing out of stone walls and saints, the statues not daring to move, when there was planning permission for anything, and morning was breakfast baps and gravel going back that road by the truck. When transparency meant the skirts just kept getting shorter. We so believed in sunshine. On rain-swept days, we'd carry sunglasses on top of our heads, just in case. Wherever we wanted to go, Ryanair would get us almost there. The world was not our problem. We still had butter on our rich tea biscuits for now, but no more coconut creams. And everywhere, statues of virgins and freedom fighters think about stretching their legs. The next one kind of flows on from that. It's self and my wife Susan were reading at a small festival up in Donegal in Marsella, which was, we were staying in this beautiful hotel. It's kind of surfing country up there. It was just at the end of the season, this time last year. And the hotel had this feeling that the heat had been turned on specially for us. It perhaps hadn't been on a lot in the previous few weeks. That kind of slight chill. And I asked the guy, so how's business? Yes, you do that these days. Well, we're closing until Valentine's Day from Monday. And I got this feeling, wouldn't it be great that that hotel, which it turns out that Blair talked on the Late Show, that he spent his childhood holidays there, which is kind of weird and strange. At that time I wrote the poem. But wouldn't it be a perfect place for an Irish remake of The Shining? So I couldn't find a computer to do the write out all the work and then play it. Jack and Bill Boy, just leave it lying somewhere, but just freak people out. But I got that when we went for a walk then and found the kind of almost nearly on the beach, the way it was arranged, the helicopter landing pad, which of course every hotel has had in the past 2 years. And I got this kind of feeling of the ghosts wandering of the last 10 years, wandering that hotel and any others, when it will be empty, it would be very soon. Tidings. The white waves crash over the Atlantic. It's Christmas Day in the empty hotel, and I am not here, so turn the heat off. The bit of grey sunlight playing by itself in the lobby is the ghost of great summers past. I'm the man who didn't survive. Winter time, the dying is difficult. Hard work and hatred. In years to come, old men will gather around the helipad and dribble on about how, in days of yore, helicopters would land here. Helicopters, in days of yore, dribble on about how around the helipad, old men will gather hatred and hard work. Difficult is the dying in winter time. Who didn't survive? I'm the man of great summers past. The ghost in the lobby playing by itself. The bit of grey sunlight, turn the heat off, so I am not here. In the empty hotel, it's Christmas Day, brash, open Atlantic, the white waves. This is the night of, not the last, but the previous North Beach poetry nights event. It's a poetry slam event in Galway. It's been a fall at a gathering in another part of the town. We didn't come to the poetry slam. It seems to have been a much more raucous affair. And this poem kind of emerged from that. And there's an epigram from Brian Cowan. I'd be a bit more cautious about that aspect of how I conduct my social life. It's called sacrifice. Sacrifice. Though the world no longer permits for the king's pleasure the Saturday night offering up of girls on the altar of the Acropolis. On a good day, we'd allow you anything short of being found on top of a live boy or a dead woman. When they come for you, the chart sheet won't mention the songs you sang in Galway, nor the morning phlegm we suffer from ourselves. You won't go to the gallows for the crime of your uncleared throat, but the shopping mall, abandoned 2 years ago, with only the underground car park completed. Its billboards will beam down the future it will never be. For all the palaces and pyramids built with gold that didn't exist. For the less we have to look forward to, you're the necessary sacrifice. These challenging times demand the wind testing the September trees as you're driven down Taylor's Hill. Next morning is your hangman whistling before he knocks. I think I'm one of those kind of middle-of-the-road people now. Initially thought, oh, well, you know, it's been a good few years, you know, a bit of a less rural, it might not be that bad. But I just can't listen to the news anymore. It's like, I wish I could sign up for the positivity. I'm starting to think that the kind of the 9 o'clock news, music, it's kind of starting to resemble the kind of worst type of drama queen mother or relative. Every time you meet them has some sort of completely unforeseen disaster that, you know, if you are having a leg amputated, they will die of a heart attack. They have to have the biggest, the best card. And this is kind of on that sort of subject, or, well, on the 90-copy news subject, and it's simply called Enough. The 90-copy news is a drama queen I can listen to no more. Each night, the economy climbs out of the TV and rides on the living room floor, clutching its left arm, a red face entirely of its own making, trying to tell me I know not what. I tell it I had a chocolate biscuit I'd rather be attending to. The Minister for Finance intervenes to say I can't change the channel for at least the next 4 years and confiscate the chocolate biscuit. Emergency budgets lurch about the place, like my baby sister in her walker 40 years ago. They'll soon be ripping all my favorite comics and the paper money I got for my birthday to shreds. The way emergency budgets and baby sisters and walkers 40 years ago always do. I ask God, government, and mother when the budget will be taking its emergency to bed. No one can say for at least the next 4 years. I beg the 9 o'clock news, please take what you speak of back and bring me anything else you have. It says nothing but helps itself to another but my chocolate biscuit. It was a very recent poem. I read I forget who wrote it now. Oh, yeah, Maeve Kelly. It's from that the Sam book of 20th century women, Irish women poets, and the White Page. And she had a poem called Prima Levi's Prayer. This is Sean Fitzpatrick's prayer. When I was God, I looked out across my glasses. Buildings went magically up, and I dreamt for you little people to be in them, happily eating chicken soup, or standing in office photocopiers. Across the golden country I made for you, I was everything you had, the reach of my lap, intercontinental. Guys with red, race week faces, and women who had too much or not enough to drink, would tug my sleeve in the hotel lobby and tell me I was doing great work, parceling up tomorrow and handing it out now. Mine was the smile that would go on forever across this face that's good for nothing since I stopped being God. Kind of swinging the other way, Kit mentioned party lines, which haven't been very happy for me. I was in town, it's always a very exotic place politically. And this guy, who I know to see, who more or less spent the entire decade of the boom walking up and down the Newcastle Road with a runny nose and a carrier bag, and he gave me a leaflet for the campaign for the right to work. And I saw him on the so this is a slightly fascist poem. And it's called the Use. Use. Now the world's jobless again, and the government stopped threatening to buy you an alarm clock. You can safely get up every afternoon and campaign for the right to work. Be back by midnight when you're jigging the first paragraph of your novel. It's not exactly a novel. With your new orange sweater and the big fat Easter egg you hide in the cupboard when anyone visits, you're every auntie's favorite charity. The skin disease you've been cultivating is coming along nicely. After we last spoke, I checked my wallet, my soul, and found some part of both missing. In more innocent times, you'd have gone to the gallows for being a rapid waste of valuable oxygen, or someone would simply have set you on fire. Your petrol was expensive, and no one could be arsed to do the paperwork. You would potter about the epochs, happy to be everyone else's fault. Um, developed into a thing where there'd be a huge demo where the leaders were, and one branch of McDonald's would have to be smashed up, and then everyone would go to the result of your pain. And someone said to me, well, that never really changed anything, which I think is probably true. But equally, very, very little was ever really changed by those who later point to life, and then went, oh, this is a brief history of those who made it point to life. On this day of tear gas and soul, the windows broken at Dickens and Jones, I can't help wondering why a history of those who made their point politely and then went home has never been written. Those who, in the heat of the moment, never dislodged a policeman's helmet, never blocked the traffic or held a country for ransom, someone should ask them, was it all worth it? All those proud men and women who never held an act that never had the National Guard sent in against them, who had left everything exactly as they found it, without adding as much as a scratch to the paintwork, with no one bothered asking, are you or have you ever been? Because we all knew damn well they never ever were. Tube strike, the nighttime news, throws up its hands and shows a train bound for Seven Sisters. The union leader argues, staff, someone there, before it's too late, when a woman alights alone at a deserted station to perhaps a waiting rapist. Half a lifetime too late. The absolute confidence of your scallion shoes singing along the platform, a sky concedes victory to November twilight. Fate, an empty waiting room. Two men, quietly up behind you, one with a broken bottle. Afterwards, their plan to chuck you on the track, rudely interrupted by a train to Ponder's End. Decades have not dissolved those minutes spent in your executioner's hands. You had to kill each of us off in our own special way. And we must be happy to remain dead. Hope, wherever you are, you've erased that November twilight from the life to which we lost you. This is called It's Another Ghost Who's Not Really a Ghost poem. And it's called Facebook Ghost, where you meet all sorts of people and they find you. but it's all fiction, of course. Facebook Ghost. With her not quite beehive, she missed the rock star bus waiting for her lover to get off the couch. She was the hell you went grinning down into. You were convenient, inconvenient. She was a car bomb. You just happened to be passing. The hell you went grinning down into. Her words were shrapnel, wolf, wife beater, pedophile, and everywhere before she tried to take them back. This morning she ghosts up out of the computer, has children now, and wants to be your friend after 16 years and 17 days, a dream broken only by the here and now of love opening the window to help the cat in and out. And significant. Your archives prove before God had the balls to put pen to paper, I was on record both for and against bank bailouts, global jihad, secret world government, the transport of the Jews to the east, and the attempt by the city council to replace, not replace, the shrubs on the green opposite. It is not insignificant. I won't name them here, but we both know of whom I speak. Dear editor, no one gives a damn what's become of the coastal towns or bothers anymore to listen to the traditional Irish harp. Dear editor, is it just me? You are what I do nights when I can't film radio stations to violently disagree with what I said last week about too many, not enough, American, French, Brazilian flags on buildings that are none of my business. For women, we, in all night doorways, we both know of whom I speak. Dear editor, I am not insignificant. I have written to the relevant authorities, but only when you say my name can I be sure I still exist. And we were going to a meeting up here in September, and Susan said, how we ended up in the subject of funerals. And she said, you should write down what you want, you know, when the time comes. So I thought, okay. And I'll finish with this. It's called The Necessary Arraignment. So I've been tormented by going around and reading it, so it's been very much in the public record. Necessary arrangements. Write it all down, she says, on the back of a tax clearance cert or one of those dead political manifestos that keep you up all night and studying. What you want done when you step out in front of a terminal 46 bus or get your leg caught in a passing combine harvester. Cease to be anywhere you can give the world the benefit of your advice. She says last time she looked, most of my parts were in adequate working order, but it's never too early to start choosing a hat for the funeral. No hat, I tell her. Turn up with a black scarf fastened to your grief-stricken head. If at all possible, get someone to sponsor the coffin. And every cent you can for the relatives. Put my dentures and other detachable bits immediately up for auction. Employ a church for the Anglicans to tell lovely lies about what I was like. A choir to sing Holidays in Cambodia as I'm rolled out the door. Poets who shuffle up sheepish, demanding a microphone from which to sing my praises should be buried with me. City fathers name anything after me and make sure it's a block of flats. Back like always, where skinny dogs can disagree to their hearts' discontent, and sellers of socialist newspapers not yet born can tell children with cigarettes and guys in boxer shorts they got free with the news of the world about the working class and how.